Thanks for listening to High Education. I'm Amelia Day, lifetime educator and social justice activist, recording from my studio apartment. Today we will be discussing community engagement, why it's needed, how the law has impacted it, and how schools can encourage growth in this area.
Why should we focus on creating a healthy relationship between schools and the community at large?
So, asking why we should be developing a healthy relationship between our schools and community at large seems like such an easy question, because it should be obvious to us as educators that if we have the investment of more people, we usually will have greater results, because we are reaching in and getting their input, which is going to provide multiple perspectives. And honestly, it's going to provide a richness of assets that we might not have otherwise. Schools, we know, are only funded with a certain amount of capital. So if we can get our parents involved, if we can get the business leaders around them involved in the education of our students, we can prolong the benefits of education. We can provide students with the knowledge that what they are investing their time and effort into is worthwhile, because they can see that their role models, their parents, their grandparents, their aunts, their uncles, whoever's raising them, cares enough about their education to be invested in it, and that the businesses that they are more than likely going to be working for care enough about them as their future employees to invest in their education as well. So anytime we have a good relationship between the school and a community, it's going to encourage student buy-in as well as family buy-in into the importance of an education. So besides that, I really want to talk about the moral imperative behind educating our youth. Now let's think about how our democracy is founded on the fact that we have an intelligent and literate population. If we are not providing our population with the tools that they need, then it's so much easier, as I've talked about before, for the population to become manipulated by leaders who might not have the best interest of them in mind. I think if you look at our current state of politics, you will see that this is really coming to a head. And so I'm hoping that people will feel the moral imperative behind creating a relationship between schools and community, because I don't think that we are funding our schools well enough to burden our schools with not only the academic success of our students, but also their social emotional success, as well as their ability to think rationally. There are so many different things that schools are becoming increasingly more responsible for. So having more people involved, more people invested, it can only help. Then there's the legality. Like, we are now required by law to develop a relationship between the school and the community. So if the moral imperative was not enough to convince you, then we go into the law. The IDEA of 2004, which is one of the most effectively implemented and successful federal policies for the integration and incorporation of school and family engagement in children's education, is a big motivator, as well as the Elementary and Secondary Act, known as Every Student Succeeds Act, which was signed in by President Obama in 2015, changes the terms, adds funding tied to school districts conducting effective outreach to all parents, provides written policies to parents and family members establishing expectations and objectives for meaningful parent and family engagements, and so much more. So it's not like we are doing above and beyond when we are creating our healthy relationships between communities and schools. We are just following the law, what is required of us. And if you're an administrator or an educational leader, then you're probably beginning to see policies or standards that are increasingly engaged in this topic. From California to Tennessee, there are standards, as well as the National Policy Board for Educational Administration, who have created the Professional Standards for Educational Leaders. They have standards that tie directly towards becoming a bridge between the community and the school. So there's the moral imperative, there's the legal imperative, but then there's also just the positive results, which I think can be motivation above other things. If you are seeing that having a community who is engaged and involved with the school provides positive results for our students, then I think that every teacher can get on board with this, because not only does it make our jobs easier, but it also should tie to your heartstrings, because why did you become a teacher in the first place? Well, you probably wanted to make a difference in a child's life, in our community's lives. And how else are we going to do it besides becoming partners with our families who are engaged in our students' lives? So the positive results that we're seeing include like academic benefits, social skills, behaviors improve. Studies have shown that students do better when they can feel the community around them, when they can feel the investment around them in them. So I know that I do so much better when I know that I have people rooting for me. And just honestly, this podcast itself has really pushed me to follow through with my commitment to becoming a better educator who's more involved with equity and who's more mindful and intentional in how I handle situations. I know that the more people who rely on me, the more I want to strive to do the best that I can. And just knowing that these families and these students are really counting on you can be a huge motivator in developing that relationship between yourself and their families. And then I also want to point out that I, for one, am highly invested in public perception of schools. I know that it hurts me whenever I see things in the news that diminish the teacher's role or that hurt our image. And so Rice University did a 2017 study of family and community engagement, which surveyed about 7,200 public school parents. And they found that 34% of public school parents stated that they were very satisfied with family and community engagement, whereas 50% of private school parents were very satisfied, and 47% of charter school parents said the same. So how is it that our schools only have a 34% approval rating? That is sad to me. And I think it really does tie in heavily to the inadequate funding that we are dealing with. And that goes into another study, which is titled What Parents Want from Public Schools. And this was written by O'Brien in 2017 based on a poll of 1,200 parents on concerns about schools. Their number one thing that they were concerned about was inadequate funding. So if you're a teacher who is really concerned about this, know that you're not alone. You have the parents behind you. They realize that this is a problem. And they also think that there's too much attention on testing. Every educator I have talked to feels this way. How is it that we still have such a pivotal point on testing, such a focus as a nation on testing, when both the teachers and the parents are saying that this is too much and they're concerned about it? And the perception that schools whose population is primarily African American and or Latino receive less funding than schools in white communities. This is something that families truly believe, and it's not based on a lie. If you look at the funding between these communities, you will find that there is more funding for suburban schools, which right now houses most of our white students, whereas urban schools, which has a higher level of diversity, are often lacking in funds. And the last thing that they wrote that they were concerned about was a lack of a voice in their child's education. If you are a teacher, a parent, an administrator, anyone, I think that this should be highly concerning to you. Because if you feel like you don't have a say in what your child is learning and how they are learning and what type of environment they are stuck in throughout the day, then you probably feel very frustrated and like you lack control in your own child's life, which to me, as someone who is not a parent yet, but who is highly invested in multiple students' lives, and as an older sister, it is hurtful to me to think that parents are stuck feeling this way and that students are stuck in situations that might not be the best for them. So to me, creating that community engagement is essential and very worth talking about.
How has U.S. law impacted educators' ability to engage their community?
I want to talk about how U.S. laws have really impacted our understanding of how to engage a community and the reason why it hasn't led to as great of a community engagement as it could have. So the first thing that I've learned about the U.S. law when it comes to this topic is a report called Coleman Report, which was published in 1966, and it labeled family background characteristics as reasons for disparate academic achievements of ethnic minority students, and it too often is used to inform deficit-based approaches in working with low-income and historically marginalized communities of racial and ethnic studies or students of color. And what that's really saying is that the Coleman Report blamed the family background for the reasons why students of color or low-income are not doing as well as those who are in high-income who might be white. And I really feel strongly that that is victim shaming. So we've talked about how our ancestors really do make a bigger impact in our lives than we know, and how the fact that our African-American students are descendants of slaves who lacked an education or a formal education that our white ancestors may have gotten really does trickle down into our current students' lives. And so for the Coleman Report to say that the reason why our ethnic students are not doing as well as our white male students is because of the family, I think is atrocious. And I'm so glad that that is no longer the law or the report that is informing educational decisions, because it's very upsetting to me that anyone could have this misconception. We should not blame families who may have lower educational. So the next I want to talk about is A Nation at Risk, which was written in 1983. This is a very controversial document that was published, and a lot of educators do not agree with it. So this one supported the need to connect families with children's school experiences if we were to close the academic achievement disparities. So that is something that it did well, but I would preface this with the statement that there's a lot flawed in that document. From there, cultural used from the 60s and 70s, and they are what informed Title I funding, as well as Head Start programs. So all of these programs, which I believe are truly still impacting our students' lives, are built upon a cultural deficit model, which I'll go on later in the episode to define and explain the differences between a cultural deficit model and a more positive mindset, which is what we would hope a mindset would be that informs our funding. So just remember that when you think about Title I and Head Start, like, these are programs that are doing a lot of good, but I think that they were handicapped by their code of ethics or their mindset of the authors. Moving into the 1980s and all the way into the first decade of the 2000s, an emergence of federal policies and guidelines to mandate parental involvement in education decisions affected them and their children. So deficit approaches were beginning to ebb as educational leaders were being held accountable to authentic parent and community engagement. In truth, definitions and illustrations of participation, involvement, and engagement were dependent on local interpretations. So what that means is that we were headed in the right direction. We are moving away from that deficit model approach towards realizing that we need to become more accountable to our community for serving our students. And so we took away that idea that it's the family's fault, that it's the parents' fault from our mindset. And instead, we started looking at our own practices to decide what are we doing that's benefiting them and what are we doing that is hurting them. And so this is definitely a step in the right direction. Moving on to the 2002 No Child Left Behind policy, 3 out of its 5 focuses were on school parental involvement policy. And then in 2004, the IDEA was published, and I already mentioned that it was one of the most effectively implemented and successful federal policies for the integration and incorporation of school and family engagement in children's education. And then finally, in 2015, Obama signed an Elementary and End Secondary Act known as Every Student Succeeds Act. And I've already talked about how that one definitely made a positive impact and is starting to guide us as we are trying to develop these community engagement policies. So this is just the historical law that has really guided educators in this topic, and I thought it might be important for you guys to know how it has evolved and how it's continuing to evolve, and it's becoming a lot more positive and a lot more effective than it was in past times.
How can schools begin building strong relationships with their community?
So my first point of advice on how schools can build strong relationships within their community is to create a design team, which has members from families, from the school, and different community members, such as like the museums around you, the businesses around you, the government officials, anyone who has some sort of investment, whether personally or professionally in the school system, should be represented within this team. And this design team should design the needs assessment, so assessing what our community needs in order to become a better community, a stronger community, developing the outcomes, so what they think should happen based on their plan, and determining the measures of success. So anytime you are implementing change into a policy or into a system, there needs to be some form of assessment ongoing to see whether it has positive outcomes, any negative outcomes that you need to reassess the policies to decrease. And this is just a natural way that policies are changed and are designed with the scientific method in mind. So I want you to think of these people whenever you think about who is involved within our students' education. Obviously the student themselves, because they know themselves the best and have the most riding on their education. Well, then we also have the family engagement, so whoever's raising them and who's a part of their lives. Then we've got the community engagement, so we need to ensure that the school improvement is done with the community, not to the community. And it should be recognized how integral schools are to the communities and how much parents and communities have to offer as partners when fundamental change must occur in schools. A school exists to educate the children of a community, and by embracing community engagement, political and educational leaders demonstrate their recognition that families and communities have an important say in what happens inside its doors. You also need to think about the school members and the educators and the paraprofessionals and all of the people who are working within the school, and then on a broader sense, the community partnership. So do you have like different outreach programs that you could partner with? I know that several of the schools that I have worked with have a direct partnership with the library and several museums within their community, in order to make sure that they are providing the best education possible and using their community resources effectively. So you should also think, when you are defining what success looks like throughout this process, you need to think about the 7 C's framework of family, school, and community engagement. So the 7 C's include collaboration, caring/compassion, culture, community, connectedness, and collective responsibility. Now, I'm not going to go through and discuss each one of these C's very much, but I think it is worth like highlighting each one. Collaboration is when members of an inclusive learning community work together as equals to assist students to succeed in the classroom. I think it's really important to remember the word equal, because a lot of times as educators, like when we're going into a parent-teacher conference, we feel confident in our own resources of knowledge because we went to school for them and we are certified. Whereas a parent, you don't have to become certified to be a parent. But I do think they are an equal partner within this relationship. Within collaboration, because while they might not have all of the wealth of knowledge that teachers have, they have so much more knowledge when it comes to their individual student. They are the expert on their child. So they have a lot to contribute. And so they should be an active member in this collaboration. Now, when it comes to communication, nothing is more important towards a community or a relationship as communication. The giving and receiving or sharing of anything, a cooperative enterprise requiring the mutual interchange of ideas and information, and out of which understanding develops and action is taken. So I really think that you need to focus on understanding. It's like whenever we're teaching our kids to read, if they are able to do it verbally beautifully, but they have no comprehension, they're not reading. Well, if we're communicating, but we're not understanding, we're not communicating. So make sure that you are really focusing on the understanding component when it comes to communication. Listen to understand. And whenever you speak, do your best to make sure that the listening partner understands. Now, caring and compassion, this is something that you can build over time. It's like empathy. You're taught it and you're not given a limited resource. And it's also something that we turn off as a defense or survival mechanism. So if you're feeling very burnt out, caring and compassion might not be something that's easily accessible to you. So it might be something that you need to focus on yourself in order to build. Then we've got our culture. Now, I'm not talking about the family's culture at this point. I'm talking about the school's culture and how it is manifesting itself through the words used, the policies, the outreach programs. That is the culture that our school has. Whether it's intentional or unintentionally built, there is a school culture. Then there's community, and obviously community is the partnership of multiple people with one goal in mind. Then there's the connectedness. So how connected does your families feel to the school and your business partners feel to the school? And then there's the collective responsibilities. This is something I really want to highlight because it's something that frustrates me personally. And I think that educators can really focus too heavily on the blame game when it comes to collective responsibility. We feel like we are doing everything we know how to do to encourage our students to grow. And when we see people in the students' lives who maybe we think are not working as hard, we feel like they have failed on their end of collective responsibility. And I want to really highlight that blame game gets us nowhere, and that we need to change our mindset from how is the parent's failing their child or how is their community failing their child, and focus heavily on how can I encourage family engagement and how can I educate my families on how to best meet their parental responsibilities. Because like I said, there's no certificate given to parents before they become parents that tells you they are doing everything. I mean, they have the training. It's something that they're learning as they go, and you as an educator can offer a helping hand rather than a judgmental face or a judgmental mouth to them. And just having that compassion and understanding, even when you see that they're not doing what you perceive as the best for their child, just knowing that you have internal biases and that their culture really defines what is best for their child as well as their personal identity, and that you don't know them as well as you might think, and that we really need to focus on the positives and rather than hyper focusing on the deficits that we feel they have. I really also want to highlight the fact that a lot of what I'm getting, not everything, but a lot of what I'm getting is provided from a book called Equity Partnerships, A Culturally Proficient Guide to Family, School, and Community Engagement. So that's really getting you set up for what you can do within your design team to really ensure that you are being intentional and mindful in the policies that you are making, in the assessments that you are doing to discover what you need to do in order to best meet your community's needs in order to become more engaged inside the school. So I do also want to point out that the authors of the book that I just mentioned also said, in our experience, simply asking families what, if any, concerns they might hold about their schools, what they really want from schools, and how they want to engage with schools provides a strong starting point for partnering and ultimately engaging with students. So maybe sending out a short survey. I know that right now with COVID-19, your parents and families are probably feeling a little frazzled or like they don't have as much time to invest. And so making it short and sweet is really the best that you can do to help them at this point. But I think that this is something that is important and it's something worth asking them to do. So finding out their perspective on what you could be doing to help engage them is really going to be a great starting point. My other advice is being intentional and valuing students' cultures as assets. So remembering that they bring experiences to the classroom that will assist both you and them in developing their education. Move away from responding to learning gaps as compliance issues and to use the transparency afforded by talking with about the gaps as a means for transforming school culture through school leaders using their internal assets of reflection and dialogue. So that means that you are opening up the floor to discuss some uncomfortable topics, but I think it's worth it, and that using reflection is a proven method for improvement in anything that you are doing, and that as educators, it is our personal and professional duty to constantly reflect on every practice. So ensuring that you are reflecting on how you are reaching out to families, the words that you're using, the tools that you're providing, making sure that they are culturally responsive, as well as really responsive to the individual's needs is important. Develop the vision, mission, and core value statements. And each teacher needs to do this. Each parent needs to do this. Each administrator needs to do this. And then from there, you can start developing the core values of the community as a whole. I really truly believe that schools who have a core value statement are doing their best to ensure that they are being intentional with their choices, and especially those choices that affect our students strongly. And then you should assess your own cultural knowledge. So identify the groups present in the school and community and ensure that you are investing some time in learning about their cultures. But you should also value diversity and develop an appreciation for the differences within and among cultural groups. So we know that within one culture, there's going to be variations in how different things are displayed in individuals. So not generalizing an entire cultural stereotype onto an individual is going to be important throughout this process. And then adapting to diversity, changing and adopting new policies and practices that support diversity, equity, and inclusion. Institutionalizing cultural knowledge, so drive change into the system of the organizations. We know that a lot of great teachers are being negatively impacted by their school's policies because it really is focusing on a deficit model rather than an inclusion model. So ensuring that if you see a problem, you speak up and you move to try to correct that issue or to communicate with your administrators is going to be really important. I also want you to keep in mind Constantino's 5 simple principles. A culture that engages every family, communicate effectively and building relationships, empower every family, engage every family in decision making, and engage the greater community. So those are just some more principles to show that I'm not just talking, I am really doing my research and trying my best to get knowledge to you that will assist you with this process. I'm going to move into what it means to use a cultural proficiency framework to assist you with this. So a culturally proficient framework is a tool that can topic in this framework is overcoming barriers to cultural proficiency. So think about things like systemic oppression, a sense of entitlement in individuals of the majority population, an unawareness of the need to adapt, resistance to change because we're satisfied with how things are, and other barriers, which when not responded to, function as default core values. So our values are our whys. People often ask teachers, what is your why? What is your reason for being a teacher? And so those whys are your values. And a community, whether they speak about it or not, they have core values. So when you allow barriers to stop change that is positive for a population in your school, whether it's the resistance from staff members or parents, when you allow these barriers to stop growth, then that becomes your community's core value. Comfort of the majority becomes the core value. So ensuring that you are not allowing barriers to define who you are and ensure that you are overcoming those barriers is going to be a huge process, but it's essential if you want to have a core value that you can be proud of. So some guiding principles of cultural proficiency include culture is everywhere. People are served differently by the culture in charge. So think about how English language learners are served compared with how our English native speakers are served. Obviously, there's a disparity there. People have group identities and personal identities. So that's going back to not making generalizations just based on who the culture of that individual. Diversity within cultural groups is important to acknowledge. Each group has unique needs that must be valued and respected. So no one group's needs is more important than the other. Families are defined by their culture and are the primary support system for our students. Families may be bicultural, and they must be. So it doesn't matter what the family's culture is. The students and their families really do need to understand the organizational culture of the school. So think about your immigrants who are moving here, who maybe were in situations where education was not a possibility for them in their home, they have zero cultural understanding of what your school expectations are. And so you are literally defining your own image based on your words and your actions towards those individuals when they meet you. So really knowing your background on new families is really important. Newcomers to our schools and communities must acknowledge, adjust to, and accept cross-cultural interactions as necessary social and communication dynamics. And the school system must incorporate cultural knowledge in educational practices and policymaking and decisions within departments. So this cultural understanding, this cultural knowledge needs to be a component in every single decision that you make, not just reading or math related ones, for example. And then there's a continuum of cultural proficiency that I really want to address, but again, I'm not going to go into too deeply because I feel like that it will become too much for one episode. So there, the continuum goes from cultural destructiveness to cultural proficiency. So if you're culturally proficient, making the commitment to lifelong learning for the purpose of being increasingly effective in serving the educational needs of all cultural groups defines you. Holding the vision of what can be and committing to assessments that serves as benchmarks on the road to student success, advocating for equity, mentoring equity leaders, and marshaling resources to eliminate inequities through high quality professional learning experiences for educators and families. That's what it means to be culturally proficient. And then to be culturally destructive means that you are seeking to eliminate vestiges of the cultures of others through negative and hostile actions or comments. And I really think back on how Native Americans were forced into missionaries basically to learn, be reprogrammed basically to meet the cultural standards of colonial America. And so I think about that when I think about cultural destructiveness. And then whenever we had the separate but equal, I called that cultural blindness, which is being unaware or pretending to not see or acknowledge the culture of others. So being culturally blind is not a good thing. And I encourage you to take the time to look at each of the proficiency abilities. There's cultural destructiveness, cultural incapacity, cultural blindness, cultural precompetence, competence, and cultural proficiency. So that you can be anywhere on that continuum and you can regress or you can progress towards a higher ability in this area depending on your mindfulness and your intentionality. The essential elements of cultural proficiency include assessing cultural knowledge, valuing diversity, managing the dynamics of differences. So knowing that there's going to be conflicts because of these differences, but there's things that we can grow from and that we can adapt to diversity. Is really important for you to just realize that just because it's different, it's not necessarily a negative thing, and that we can honor both of our differences without being forced to become the same, basically. And then the last element is institutionalizing cultural knowledge. So making sure that it's within our textbooks for our students and our teachers is going to be important. And I really encourage you to look at that equity partnership book that I mentioned. And I'm going to be posting on my website, highedpod.com, a rubric for the family, school, and community engagement process. So the way you as a school district or an individual teacher can go through and assess your current state, as well as areas that you can grow in. And like I said, I will be posting that on my website, and I really encourage you to use that as a tool if your school is focusing on becoming a community that is engaging all members and not just the teachers and students. Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening to High Education. If you enjoyed what we talked about, be sure to like and subscribe. Proceeds from this episode will be donated to Save the Children. You can learn more about how you can support us and what we talked about today by visiting us at highedpod.com.